I'm Derek Russell.
And I'm Brad Locke, and this is The Memo,
a gathering of all things Northeast Mississippi, brought to you by The Daily Journal and DJournal.com.
Good morning and welcome to The Memo for Wednesday, August 23rd. I'm Chris Kiefer and joined today by Daily Journal Features Editor, Leslie Chris. How are you today, Leslie?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
Doing great. It's the Chris and Chris show today.
That's right. That's kind of cool.
No Derek, no Brad. As we talked about last week, of course, Brad has now moved into the sports section of the Daily Journal, so he will no longer be hosting. And Derek is just out today. Couldn't make it in this morning, so we're joined by Leslie and glad to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Leslie, did you watch the eclipse on Monday?
I did.
What'd you do? Where'd you watch it?
I watched it out in front of this building, actually, most of the time. In fact, someone put a photograph on my desk yesterday. I'm not even sure who or who took it, but it's a picture of Rod, the editor, and me just standing out front with our glasses on, staring up at the sky. And, of course, we know what we're doing, but, you know, years from now, if someone finds that photograph, they're going to wonder what in the world we were staring up in the sky doing.
With glasses on, though.
Yeah, with glasses on. I know mine were the correct ones. I don't know. Rod was not sure about his. Time will tell.
Yeah, I was out. I went out and did a video with some students watching the eclipse. So I was kind of out in the field. Were there a lot of people here in the parking lot?
There were a few down on the end of the building when I drove in. I actually went and had lunch first, and when I was driving back up Eason and Cliff Gookin to here, there were tons of people out in different parking lots, and many of them had no glasses on and were just staring up at the sky. And one of the guys I saw was out of some medical building with scrubs on, and I thought, surely he knew better.
You should know better. Yeah, I drove, and kind of right about the time of the peak of the eclipse, was driving from Moorville Middle School to Thomas Street School. And so same thing as I was going, I guess, about the same place down Cliff Gookin and Eason, there were a whole bunch of people. It was kind of neat. It was, people thought about this communal event and people watching it together.
How did they react?
So in some ways, I'd say it depended on the age of the students. I started at the elementary school, and they were really into it, and they would look up, and it was a lot of, this is Moorville Elementary, oh, cool, and exclamations. And when I went over across the street and went to the middle school, I think they were a little bit more like, just cool being
teenagers.
Outside. Yeah, being teenagers. And then over at Thomas Street, you kind of got that sense of wonder a little bit more, too. I'd say probably... I didn't watch it with high school students. Maybe they would have appreciated it more. And I think the younger kids, but probably the middle school students the most, were probably just a little too cool. I thought it was going to be more here. I guess I didn't know what to expect. But when they talked about, 93%, 94%, I just thought it was going to be darker. Like, I thought it was going to feel more like dusk.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if you didn't have the glasses on, and I was able to borrow someone's glasses and look up at it real quick, you really wouldn't have noticed much was happening.
Well, we were talking about, Justin and I were talking about how, you know, it wasn't dark, but when you walked outside here without the glasses, it was an oddness.
The air was kind of still.
It was odd, and it was it wasn't really dark, though my father called me from East Tupelo and said that the street lights had come on.
Yeah, at Thomas Street School, they came on, too. We saw that. That was neat. But I know what you mean. Part of me wondered if it was just in my mind, because I knew an eclipse was going on, so I thought it felt different, or if it really
did. No, I don't think so. I think it did. It just looked different outside.
Yeah.
But certainly not dark.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I hope everyone listening got a chance to enjoy it before the next one comes in 2024, I think. And then, there was a map somewhere I saw online. There's been all these articles, of course, on the eclipse, of all the ones that are coming up. And there's some, and they're not for a long time, but there's a bunch that are going to pass right over Tupelo in like the 2060s or something. You know, they've got them all mapped out for 100 years or something
really
down the road.
Here.
But anyway, if you hold on, maybe Tupelo will be in the middle of it, like two or three, maybe two in a row.
I think the one in 2024 is supposed to be
Arkansas.
And we may get a little more of it than this last time. I'm not sure.
I couldn't tell. I was trying to tell that from reading the map. But I think it's Carbondale, Illinois got both of them. It kind of crossed right in the middle of, so lucky them, I guess.
I bet they got a lot more tourist dollars.
Yeah.
This past week.
Eclipse tourism. Well, anyway, we got a good show for you today. We will be joined by William Moore in a little bit to talk about the all the craziness surrounding the Lee County Jail. And I guess supervisors voted in what I think was a surprise move the other day to not build a new jail, but to stay at the old one and renovate it. And that's kind of caused some consternation from the sheriff. And William will fill us in more on that. Caleb Bedillion is going to talk about expansion on West Jackson Street. And part of the major thoroughfare, widening the street a little bit and what that'll look like. Bobby Harrison will talk about the efforts to change the school funding formula and where that stands. And Lauren Wood will talk about her photo essay on mixed martial arts. Let's get to it.
Morning, William Moore.
Morning.
How are you?
Doing good today.
You've had a lot of on your plate lately with this jail
It's been a couple of interesting days.
Really, I'm after reading your story the past couple of days, and then hearing about the prisoners that have been freed to open up more space. I'm a little concerned about that.
Well, that's one of the things that the sheriff mentioned. The fact that in his opinion, there are people that are being let loose that should still be in jail. But as he said, that's not his decision. He doesn't determine how big the jail is. He just runs the jail.
So where it stands now, are we just going to put a Band-Aid on the old jail?
That appears to be. I mean, where it stands right now, the county supervisors voted to renovate the jail, to not expand it. So, I mean, they're still stuck at the 200-bed limit, which means the sheriff still has to work hard to get down to that limit, because they were running anywhere from 230 to 240 prisoners per day. And yesterday afternoon, or Tuesday afternoon, he got it down to 203 at one point, but this morning it was back to 210, because there's steadily people being arrested and brought to jail. But because there's no room at the jail, a lot of these people are, they're being booked in, and then either being bonded out almost immediately or being released on their own recognizance, depending on what the charges are.
And that's how he's picking who to let loose. Obviously or hopefully there are no horrible criminals among those that are being set loose.
Basically, the ones that are being released are going to be, what's considered nonviolent. Of the 36 that they had to start turning loose, folks that were already sitting in jail, most of them were, drug-related charges, trespassing, bad checks, no driver's license, contempt of court. Most of them were small things like that, but there were some, felonies in there, and there were a couple of folks who have been arrested for, domestic violence. There are certain people, that you prefer to stay in there. They're having to be let out because they are, the lesser of two evils, so to speak. And what's happening now, basically, when somebody gets arrested, they have to weigh, all right, how serious is the crime? First off, it has to be a serious enough crime to arrest somebody.
Yeah.
To know, all right, well, they need to go to jail and they need to stay in jail, and then if it's somebody that's serious enough, a decision has to be made, all right, well, if we keep, say somebody gets arrested for murder, all right, in order to keep that murder suspect in jail, you're going to have to release somebody else. And that's one of the situations. It's not just the problem for Lee County. Prentice County is in the same situation. Prentice County is under a federal decree to not have any more than 70 prisoners. And they're in the same situation. All right, well, somebody goes to trial and gets convicted in circuit court, by law, they have to be transported straight from the courtroom to the county jail. And if there's no room at the jail and they have to accept them, somebody's got to be turned loose. It's an unfortunate situation right now, and basically the way things are being handled, people who are being arrested are basically being taken up to the jail, booked in, and pretty much being released in a short period of time.
Is there a cheer that goes on inside the jail whenever a new prisoner comes that one of them's getting out? No, I'm teasing.
I don't know. That's one of the serious things that, after the when the supervisors voted Monday 3-2 not to build a new jail. Also, I mean, it set the tone for, all right, well, there's going to be no new jail, so there's going to be no relief for overcrowding. So basically, it forced the sheriff's hand. All right, so he had to start figuring out, all right, who do we get rid of? So, I mean, he was in that situation Monday afternoon, having to go back and look at basically, all right, well, who's in jail? Can they be released? Should they be released?
But I guess what I was curious about on those lines is, suppose the supervisors had said, yes, we're going to build a new jail. It would not have been ready.
It would have still taken a couple of years probably to get all the plans done and get a jail built.
So the same overcrowding would have been there whether the supervisors voted yes or no, right? Is this just kind of a frustration by Johnson or?
Part of it's up under frustration. But you know, if they would have said, all right, we're going to build a new jail, I mean, there would be the potential for future relief. So, I mean,
so if there was a lawsuit,
they could say, all right, we're working on the situation. You know, right now, the situation is, all right, there's no relief in sight. So if there is a lawsuit, they're going to be ordered to release prisoners. So, you know, now they're under the situation where they can at least choose which ones are released. You know, and it's a quirk of the law. You know, the state constitution says that counties have to build jails, have to operate a jail. But the same law says basically all they have to accept are county prisoners and folks who are, you know, involved in circuit court cases or folks who have been committed by chancery court. You know, so once somebody gets arrested in the city, the county jails do not have to legally accept them. But here in Tupelo, in Lee County, 20 years ago, when they built the current jail, there was a interlocal agreement where they signed a contract where the county agreed to accept all Tupelo prisoners if there is room at the jail. You know, basically, it was done as a way to make sure that the jail stayed occupied and they would get a per diem for each prisoner to help operate the jail. You know, now the problem is, you know, the jail's full. You know, Monday afternoon when I looked, I mean, there were 231 prisoners at the jail. 101 of them were Tupelo Police Department.
Yeah.
So, you know, and basically what this is going to do, right, the way it stands now, since they're under contract to accept Tupelo prisoners, the only ones that they can basically say, no, we can't really take, or the bulk of the ones they say, no, we can't take, are going to be the smaller municipalities. Baldwin, Saltillo, Guntown, Plantersville, Verona, Shannon, Nettleton, because they don't have a contract.
What do you think is going to happen?
Because
you were at the supervisors meeting Monday.
The sheriff basically called the question Monday, said, you know, we need to know what's going on. Or he wanted to know what was going on. Are you going to build a new jail or not? And the supervisors basically decided, all right, right now at this point, we're going to go against raising taxes and we're going to see if we can't renovate the existing jail and limit the number of prisoners coming in. I have a feeling that, you know, a little ways down the road, folks will see, all right, well, this is just a Band-Aid on a 20-year-old jail that needs lots of work. And just turning folks loose when they get arrested is not really a viable option for a long term. And I have a feeling that the whole new jail will be revisited sometime shortly.
Do you think they just tried to go too big? And maybe that was a mistake going with a 600-bed in the beginning. Maybe if they would have gone for something smaller, it would have passed more easily?
I don't know. I mean, I can see where a 500 or 600-bed jail would work. But in order for that to work, you're going to have to accept state and federal prisoners.
And raise taxes, which got into the problem.
But the state and the federal prisoners would offset the ongoing cost, the operational cost. You know, they hadn't done any kind of study to look into, all right, well, what is the possibility of getting state prisoners? What's the possibility of getting federal prisoners? You know, and another thing, I mean, they hadn't looked at, all right, well, what would the daily operating cost be? What would we have to charge other entities to bring their prisoners here? You know, there were still a lot of questions that hadn't been asked. Basically, the sheriff said, all right, we need a new jail. They got an architect to look into it, and, you know, just at the 600-bed figure, went out and looked at similar jails that had been built recently and said, all right, well, it's going to cost $50 million. You know, a lot of the details hadn't been worked out before this plan was shot down. So, I mean, I have a personal feeling, you know, that it might be revisited.
Renovations on a building like that are going to be costly, too.
Renovations will be very costly because, I mean, you know, it's a law enforcement facility. You're trying to keep prisoners, so just construction costs are higher anyway. Yeah. And the building's been used for 20 years. All the door locks have to be replaced. I mean, the door locks are made by a company that's been out of business for over a decade. I mean, and literally the folks at the jail, when something breaks, they have to go on eBay to find parts.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a lot of antiquated parts out there in the jail. I mean, it could be renovated. I mean, because that's part of what, you know, one of the original plans was, all right, well, we'll build a new jail. And then once we move all the prisoners over there, we'll go back and we'll rehab the old jail. So, I mean, that is a option that would cost less money than building a whole big brand new jail. You know, and then there's the other questions that are still to be asked. All right, do you build a justice court included with that? And also the whole issue of a morgue, because Lee County has been using the morgue at the North Mississippi Medical Center in the hospital for years has been saying, y'all need to build your own morgue. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, Tupelo and Lee County might be, you know, the largest, you know, county in the region, you know, but they don't have a morgue. You know, and even Monroe County has a morgue.
Wow. Well, I guess the saga will continue.
Yeah, one thing too, William, I know there's been a lot of bad blood on this issue, or seems to have been some bad blood between city leaders and county leaders. And it seems like maybe one of the big issues throughout this has been that there's not been a lot of communication between the city and the county. Can those – Caleb had a story last week also that after the, I guess, the meeting for the hearing.
The public hearing.
Yeah, and then the mayor had a Facebook post saying don't support a tax increase, and then the sheriff had a Facebook post back saying, fine, then we won't take your prisoners. Can some of those fences be mended and them work together going forward? Is it pretty irreparable? What do you think?
I don't think it's irreparable. I think that basically this has shown that there are issues. The fact, all right, well, even though it's the county's, the supervisor's responsibility to build a jail and it's the sheriff's responsibility to run the jail, there are more parties involved in the jail than just the supervisors and the sheriff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to show, all right, we need to ask everybody. You know, we need to get involved with the other municipalities, you know, especially the smaller ones, because, you know, the Mayor Baldwin pointed out, all right, well, if you quit taking our prisoners and we have to build a jail, all right, well, the supervisors might not be having to be forced to make a tax increase, but the city of Baldwin will have to increase taxes in order to house prisoners or transport them to another facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
they kind of need everybody at the table together. Then.
They do, and that's one of the things, you know, the board president Phil Morgan pointed out. Well, he wants to meet, you know, here in the near future with the sheriff and with all these municipalities to see what can be done. You know, his idea was to look at, you know, what can be done with the existing jail. But I'm thinking that those talks might go a little further and point out the need. All right, well, 200 beds is not enough. You know, mm-hmm. folks come to Tupelo to shop, and they also come to Tupelo folks come to Lee County to shop, and they also come to Lee County to commit crimes. So it's one of those things where, you know, we're a regional leader, but
that's one of
the downsides of, you know, being the biggest town in the region.
Yeah, sure. More crime, too.
There's more crime here, and there's more people get arrested. It's unfortunate, but it's a fact of life. Uh-huh. You know, and something's going to have to be done.
Well, we'll keep watching. We'll keep reading your stories to keep up with it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Wake up and get ready for your day with the Daily Journal's News Break, a quick summary of news, sports, weather, and everything else Northeast Mississippi in a 5-minute video. Shows will be posted every Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. You can watch them for free at any time at djournal.com, Facebook, YouTube, or the Daily Journal's mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Stay informed on the latest happenings in your community in an easily digestible format.
And if you missed the sound of Brad Locke's voice, I don't know why, but you can hear it on the Prep Rally podcast. Prep Rally is a high school sports podcast with Brad Locke and new high school sports reporter Dalton Middleton. New episodes air every Wednesday. You can listen to it free in iTunes, podcast apps, or at PrepRally.djournal.com. Also, Ole Miss and Mississippi State fans, check out the Double Coverage podcast. Ole Miss beat reporter Parrish Alford and Mississippi State reporter Logan Lowry release a new episode. It's usually Thursday afternoon. Sometimes the day varies, in which they provide game previews, insight, commentary, and analysis on the Bulldogs and Rebels. Listen free in iTunes, podcast apps, or at doublecoverage.djournal.com. Local government reporter Caleb Bedillion joins us now to talk about an upcoming project on West Jackson. I guess that's looking like maybe the next area Major Thoroughfare Program is looking at going forward.
That's right, Chris. So right now, Major Thoroughfare is paying for the construction of an interchange at the end of Thomas Street extended with the new Highway 6. And that will probably take most of their funding through the current, probably into the next fiscal year as well. But they're looking at very soon beginning the engineering and design work on a proposal to widen West Jackson Street. Now, this widening would be between the intersections of Clayton to the west and Robin Street and Highland Circle on the east side. So it would be that stretch of West Jackson between those intersections. And the idea is to add a continuous turn lane. So it's two lanes right now. So they'd widen the road. So there'd still be two travel lanes, east-west, with one turn lane in the middle that would run the entire length of that corridor.
That'd be shared by both directions.
Right. That'd be shared by both directions. You know, theoretically, they've talked about adding more than one turn lane at the actual intersection with Gloucester, so that you could have maybe two left-turning lanes, so that you could have two dedicated left-turning lanes in each direction, because that Gloucester intersection is quite busy, but there just may not be the room for that many turn lanes. The design work, engineering hasn't begun yet, and tightness is going to be a problem the entire stretch. You know, it's a lot of residential. There is some commercial in that area as well, and it's all very close to the road. So possibility Major Thoroughfare is going to have to actually buy some property for their right-of-way. That's something they've tried to avoid in the past. They've, you know, just have focused on projects where they weren't going to have to do that because the right-of-way that existed was already sufficient. Or I know there were a few places where people donated right-of-way, but that would have just been land. Here we actually have structures that are extremely close to the proposed construction zone.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. I guess there's maybe a little bit of, to say, controversy or at least concern about this project. You had in your story on Sunday that there's some homeowners in the area that are just concerned about what might happen. You got some houses that are pretty close.
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot, but I mean, I've heard of a little rumbling. I know there is some concern, you know. There are a lot of residences throughout that whole West Jackson area, but I mean, it is mixed. There's commercial as well. I know some residents feel the traffic on West Jackson Street already goes too fast. And if you add more lanes and you get left-turning traffic out of the travel lanes, the traffic that's left is going to be moving even faster. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, yeah, we don't know until the design is done what kind of impact this might have on residences in terms of how close potential homes are going to be to the new area. That's just, there's no design yet, so they're not quite sure, you know, how that's going to work. One thing that's going to drive the cost up is, since it is so tight, they're not going to be able to just move utilities further out. So they're going to have to bury the utilities. And that will include, you know, electricity. That'll be water and light. We've also got AT&T involved. We've got some other utility companies, I believe. Some sewer and water lines may have to be relocated. So that's going to be a problem. When this project was pitched during the vote for Phase 6 of Major Thoroughfare, which was in the spring of 16, so over a year ago now, the estimated price tag that was attached to it was $540,000. no one quite knows now where that number came from. Because, I mean, even just to discuss the scale of the project, if you've been around this kind of stuff, you know that price is ludicrously low. And now the newest price estimates are between $3 million and $3.5 million, wow, with potentially $1 million of that just for utility relocation. And that number doesn't even include property purchasing if that becomes necessary. So, I mean, if they start having to buy land throughout that whole corridor, we could easily see hundreds of thousands of dollars added to that total. So, I mean, you know, on the high end, this could end up over $4 million.
So what does it mean for the scope of all the major thoroughfare projects if this one goes over by $3.5-4 million? Well, other stuff's just going to get kicked back to
it. Right, right. I mean, every phase of major thoroughfare, they've always had more projects on the list than they knew they would be able to do. Mm-hmm. That way, you know, they're not in a situation, you know, voters approve the program for a five-year period, but then they also approve the list of projects. It'd be a little awkward if they finished all the projects and had more money but nothing to do with it. So they've always approved more projects, and that also gives them flexibility. You know, for example, North Gloucester trying to add some turn lanes and such throughout that Barnes Crossing area was on their list, but as it turns out, MDOT is doing some North Gloucester work. So that way, you know, if they had had that Gloucester work on there and nothing else, obviously they'd prefer MDOT to do it because MDOT's funding it. So to have more projects than needed, that gives them flexibility. Or if they decide, you know, based on development, one area is going to be much more important than another. So there's always some intentional flexibility built into the program. But, yeah, I mean, especially with 25% this year of the revenue diverted to maintenance. Mm-hmm. So that's trying to resurface, repair, you know, retain previous major thoroughfare projects. So that's 25% of their revenue off the top. Yeah, if West Jackson goes significant, you know, if they were to get into it, it just kind of kept spiraling. If we ended up over $5 million, I mean, it would significantly impact the ability to do projects after that.
And remind me how much it's 5 years and how much does that generally bring in?
Yeah, if I recall correctly, it's about $20 million, okay, over each renewal phase.
Over the 5 year period.
Yeah, over the 5 year period. It may be a touch over $20 million. I can't remember for sure, but it's somewhere in that figure.
And I guess it's not common to have projects that you mentioned at the top, the Thomas Street project. That's one that's been over several phases, correct?
Yeah. Seems like they've been working on that for a while. It's at least to phase five, and I'm pretty sure it was originally on the list for phase four.
Sure.
And it just has always never made the priority while they were working on other projects. And it was supposed to be phase five, and then there was only enough money in phase five's revenue at the end to get started but not to finish it. So that's kind of a hybrid. There was a little bit of phase five money left, which, you know, that ended early 16. Mm-hmm. And then early phase six money is being used to finish it. So it's getting a little bit of both. And so West Jackson will be the first true Phase 6 project.
And it's still, you wrote, it's still about a year away.
Oh, at
least. That's from starting?
That's not
completion. So that's just starting,
the
huh?
The city is about to approve a contract with an engineering firm to start designing the project. The big deal will be when Thomas Street finishes, because obviously, you know,
major thoroughfare. Is there a timeline on that?
I mean, it's underway now.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I think they would like to see it finished this year.
Okay.
We'll see if the weather, I mean, you know, last year, as everyone will recall, we had a drought. So with the dry weather, you know, construction and milling went very late into the year last year. If we had another dry fall, they could potentially work all the way up into November and probably get Thomas Street done. If we start having a very wet fall, they'll have to shut it down. So that's still up in the air.
Sure. All right. Well, thanks, Caleb. We'll be following where it goes from here and checking out your stories. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Sure thing.
Watch the Daily Journal's Capitol View webcast each Monday afternoon at djournal.com. Capitol Bureau Chief Bobby Harrison provides commentary and analysis on the issues being debated in Jackson. Watch live on Monday afternoons at 2 o'clock or catch the replay later in the day.
We now go down to Jackson to talk with Bobby Harrison about school funding. Bobby, how's it going today?
All right, Chris, how are you doing?
Good, doing well. So, obviously, we talked a lot in the spring about, you know, the legislative leadership had this determination to change the school's funding formula, and nothing happened. You talked to him over the weekend, though, and that still remains a priority, right?
They say it's still a priority, but there doesn't seem to be much work going on towards that priority right now, Chris. Tate Reeves, Lieutenant Governor, said it would pick up as they got closer to the legislative session beginning in January, but it just seems that it seems, if you want to be truthful, that it just the effort to rewrite the Mississippi Adequate Education Program just really hit a wall.
So backing up, I guess, this all started, I guess it was maybe about a year ago, maybe a little bit less, probably. Was it about October when they kind of made that surprise announcement that they were hiring EdBuild and so forth?
Yeah, it was October, actually, so it was a little less than a year ago, when Lieutenant Governor Reeves and House Speaker Philip Gunn had a press conference that was, you know, kind of out of the blue, where they announced they had hired this New Jersey firm, EdBuild, to undertake the rewrite of the Mississippi Adequate Education Program and pay them, I think it was $100,000 in state funds. And they were, you know, supposed to get a recommendation finished by the end of the year. Mind you, this was already October for the to be considered during the 2017 legislative session. And the plan that they set at the time was to do the rewrite during the 2017 session. Of course, that didn't come to fruition. Matter of fact, they wasn't even able to file a bill that actually had any details of what that rewrite was going to be. And they said, well, we may do it in a special session, but now, obviously, after the regular session ended, but obviously that's not going to happen now. So we just have to see what happens in 2018.
The issue, I guess, seemed to be that they couldn't get enough consensus. And I guess from what you were saying at the top is you're not certain that the consensus has necessarily formed in the time between sessions.
Yeah, Chris, I'm going to write more about this later on, but I got a theory about this.
Do tell.
If you want to hear. Now, going back, the MAEP, Mississippi Adequate Education Program, was passed in 1997. That's only been fully funded twice, and in the past 6 years, as though it's $2 billion short of, $2 billion short of full funding. But when it was passed in 1997, there was a great deal of consensus in doing it. It was considered landmark legislation. I mean, school districts would, you know, get a set amount of money based on a formula that's really not as complicated as people want to say, but there's a formula and that gives the legislature supposed to be obligated to provide that amount of money to each school district. And, you know, the poorer the school district, the more school district gets in state money to kind of, you know, balance things out. And why the reason there was such a consensus about it in 1997, there was a commitment in there in the legislation to provide every school district's going to get more money over, you know, it's going to be phased in over a 5 or 6 year period. And after that period ended, each school district, not each school district, but it'd be $130 million more going to the local school district.
In the total formula, sure.
The winner. But right now, what it appears that the legislative leadership wants to do is just redivide the same pot of money because, you know, the revenue's not growing right now. There's no anticipation that it's going to grow in the next few years. So what they're doing is just redividing the same pot of money. So if you do that, there's going to be school districts that win and school districts that lose. So, you know, so you got local legislators saying, I don't know if I want to vote for this or there's a possibility my school district's going to get less money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a problem that, you know, when you redivide the same pot of money, there's going to be losers and, you know, and a legislator would be a fool from politically speaking to vote to give his school district less money. And I think that's pretty much in a nutshell what's going on right now.
Do you also get the impression, I know this was some of the controversy when they first announced it, when you talk about redividing that pot of money, would that pot of money be what MAEP required full funding, or would they kind of look at what they've been spending recently and put that into the legislation so that they weren't constantly underfunding and that their overall obligation would be less?
Well, I mean, you know, that's the point, that, you know, that they can't afford to fully fund MAEP. So, you know, there were folks in the media, including myself, were, you know, saying which would generate more money, the MAEP formula or the Ed Bill formula. And that really wasn't the question, because, you know, if they can't fully fund MAEP, even if the Ed Bill generates more money, how are they going to fund that? So, mm-hmm. I, in hindsight, that was kind of a pointless question. I mean, the question, you know, is using the same pot of money, which I think is all they can do right now, because, you know, every agency's had to have cuts or, you know, has had sustained cuts over the past couple of years because of revenue shortfalls. If you divide the same pot of money, the question is which school districts are going to be winners, which school districts are going to be losers. And the legislative leadership understood that, even though they don't want to say that, because that's why they never released a bill that actually had a formula mm-hmm. in it.
Because as soon as you do that, people can start figuring it out and determine who those winners and losers are going to be, I guess. I guess part of this, Bobby, at least as a talking points, is a philosophical difference, or that's what Reeves and Gunn are saying, is what the formula they're looking at would be more student-based rather than MAEP right now is looking at an average cost. Can you kind of explain a little bit?
You know, that's what they say. I think you could make the argument that MAEP is student-based. And then, at least partially, a school district gets more money for what they call the at-risk students, which is essentially students from low socioeconomic background. Under Ed Bill, it's actually more complicated, and they say they want to make it simpler, but, you get more money for teaching kids where English is a second language. You get more money for at-risk students under Ed Bill, the Ed Bill closes it too, and you get more money for special ed, you get more money for gifted students. So, I mean, in that sense, it is that's what, when they say student-based, that's what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But, the key thing is under the Ed Bill formula, the base cost is a number picked out of the air by the legislators, so there won't be an obligation that the former generate a certain amount of money. They just say, this is the base cost, and then we're going to add on that base cost with your at risk students, your English as a second language student, your special ed students, and whatnot. But the legislation doesn't have the obligation to fund a formula, which they've proven over the years they're not willing or able to do.
I see. So in other words, they could change that base cost year to year. Is that right?
Right. I mean, sure.
Districts would really have no idea in advance what they were going to get. And conversely, you wouldn't be able to say it's underfunded because the legislature just determined this is what the base cost is.
I think what this does would do is take a political talking point away from those who say that the legislature is not fully funding education.
I got you. Looking at the statements in your story from Tate Reeves and Philip Gunn, it would seem like this is maybe a bigger priority for Reeves. I mean, they're both talking about it. Gunn had said, hey, we don't want to rush the process. We want to do it right. And Reeves seems more determined to do it ASAP. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Well, this is purely speculation on my part. But it was my impression at the time, when they had the press conference, it was actually a bigger priority for Gunn than Reeves. But that might have changed since that October press conference. But that was the impression I got at the time.
Sure, and maybe that reflects just where the consensus is among the House compared to the Senate, or maybe Gunn's having more difficulty in building consensus.
I do think. Generally speaking, Gunn on controversial issues that the House is a little bit more diverse, and so Gunn has more trouble rounding up his votes than Lieutenant Governor does.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an issue that has been talked about for a while, and it's probably not going away as we go into another session, so I'm sure we will have more from you on it, Bobby. Thanks for your time.
All right, thanks. Y'all take care.
You too.
We're joined now by photographer Lauren Wood. And Lauren, you're in focus this past Monday. I thought it was pretty cool.
It's pretty intense.
That was really cool.
Did you want it to be in black and white, or was that just how it? Did you ask for it to be black and white?
Yes.
Okay, I was curious about that.
Yeah. So yeah, it was not a mistake. And it was probably some people were like, wait, why is this black and white?
Explain that for people who aren't as familiar with photography, why you wanted it to be black and white.
I kind of just wanted it to be like, it had crazy lighting there. And black and white kind of gets rid of distractions like that. And it also makes it a little more like raw and gritty and just like you just focus on the subjects. Like you immediately just kind of see that. So whereas, you know, not knocking color photography, like it obviously can add dynamics in mm-hmm. other situations. But for this, it was just like, boom, you know, or silhouette shots or kind of, you know, different things where it would like add to it. So.
I love black and white photography still. Yeah. But it just, you know, when you're used to seeing color in the mm-hmm. paper, when I turned the page, I thought something must have been wrong with the press.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear uh-huh. that you asked for it to be black and white.
Yep. So yeah, definitely a design choice.
I wondered if maybe we did it in black and white so people wouldn't be squeamish about seeing the blood gushing from her nose.
I know, right? Yeah, I can't really see it as well, but it was still.
So how did you come up with this idea?
So we actually, for Mud and Magnolias, did a story at the UFM gym on like little ones that do jujitsu. And Grady Hurley is the owner there, and he's like, you know, MMA champion in town and stuff. And he was telling me, I actually was starting to do another In Focus. Hopefully that may pick up soon. But it was on this young girl, and she was going to do her first MMA fight. And just her opponent backed out though. So it was a bummer. Like I got photos of her training and we're going to do this, you know, story, but hopefully again, I can pick that up.
So
later.
More mixed martial arts coming.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. But I knew this fight was coming up and I was like, oh, it might be cool. I've never been to one. I've just kind of seen them on TV and, you know, just kind of, just to go and kind of get sights and sounds and obviously get some fighting pictures, but then more like behind the scenes and kind of what's going on. And it was really cool. Like I sadly only stayed till like the intermission, but there were 17 fights.
Wow.
Or 17 matches.
How long does the whole thing take?
It kind of depends. Like it's somewhat similar to boxing where if you have like a TKO, the round's over. So a round can, like one match lasted like 30 seconds, like done. It was probably one of the first couple, it was done very fast. But other than that, there are three rounds of, I think, 5 minutes,
okay,
if I'm not mistaken. And there's a break in between each round.
So 17 fights could go hours.
I got there at 6 o'clock. I didn't leave until like after 10 o'clock.
And
I was
only
halfway through. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
There were still like seven more. And they were the bigger, like, headline fights. And I was, like, kind of bummed about that because, like, Grady Hurley ended up winning and everything. It's like, oh, that would have been cool. But,
Yeah, it's fun.
Looks like it's extremely well attended, too.
Yes, there were tons of people there. And it was just, like, really cool to go and experience. And, like, you know, there were two lady fighter, you know, that was cool. And one little boy's face was just, like, what? Like that's right. So that's cool. But, you know, and it was like some kids were in high school, still like high school age, like under 18 or
fighting.
You just, if you're training and you're in the weight class and everything, like I'm pretty sure one kid said he was like 16 or 17, if I remember incorrectly.
Wow.
I don't want to get that wrong. But, you know, younger all the way up through old, like actually the lady, they said that she was 40. Like, she traveled from Georgia to come fight.
Wow.
And she was 40. Wow. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. So it's like, you know, a big age span too. And people from all over, like, a lot in the, obviously, North Mississippi area. But Memphis, Jackson, you know, like, Georgia, from more around the region, people coming and doing this. So
how often do you know, do they have competitions here?
That's a good question. I know they usually hosted them at the Furniture Market.
Mm-hmm.
But they said the next one would probably be in November.
Okay.
So probably every couple months or, you know, I don't know, a couple times a year kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, great pictures.
Thanks. It was really cool to photograph it. Like, you know, it's just unlike anything I've ever kind of really photographed. So it was really, really neat to do that.
So what's up next?
Got to figure that out. I'm actually sourcing it this week and trying to call people and see. So
if people have ideas, can they send it to you?
Yeah, for sure. I'd love that.
Email it. Mm-hmm. lauren.wood@journalink.com.
Yep, that'd be great. So always looking.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
All right, Leslie, good show today.
Thanks. It was fun.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you. Maybe we can get you back on Friday.
Sure.
Derek should be back then, but yeah, if your schedule allows, we'd love to have you
sure.
too.
I'll be here.
That's of course is our entertainment podcast. We'll have the food, Jenna Parson talking about the food section, and Scott Morris doing his movie review, and Derek talking about the weekend entertainment scene.
Jenna brought you any food yet? Because I know she's brought the other two. Well, it's time. You should put out a request.
I'm not going to whine about it like they did. I'll just put it that way.
The squeaky wheel.
Exactly right. You can catch us on Twitter @DJournalMemo. That's a great way to get when new episodes come out. However you're listening to us, of course, there are multiple ways. You can catch us on iTunes. We're in various podcast apps. Stitcher, Satchel, Player FM, Google Play. You can stream us right through the website, memo.djournal.com. And you can also follow the Daily Journal on Twitter @DJournalNow. All the stories we talked about are in your Daily Journal or at djournal.com. And we will see you on Friday. Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.